Welcome to Out There with TJ Ryan. It's strange. It's unusual. It's mysterious. It's out there, out there, out there, out there. And now your host, TJ Ryan.
Thanks for joining me on another show. This week we talked to somebody that, well, it's probably been a while since I've had her on. She's written several books now, and a lot of it has to do with Sasquatch, Uncle Sass, and also UFOs. And it's very, she always takes a very scientific approach with her work. And, or in this case, maybe she's just having some fun. The name of the book, Forgotten Tales of Michigan's Upper Peninsula, the author I'm talking about, and investigator Lisa Scheel. How you doing, Lisa?
I'm good.
Now, you're over near Jacobsville.
Yep, way up in the Keweenaw.
In Upper Michigan, those of you not familiar. And she's not actually in Jacobsville because she's actually out in the woods. You have quite a bit of land out there?
Yep, in the middle of the woods.
And you live out there with your family. And yep. You enjoy it very much, don't you?
I love it out here.
Isn't that something? It's just a great, how would you describe it?
It's just a very peaceful and yet mysterious place.
Yeah, it's also like an energetic. Do you feel like energy living out there?
Sometimes.
I know when I go out in the woods, and maybe when you're around it all the time you don't notice it, but if you've been living away from it, you know, and then you go out there, it's just this incredible feeling that comes over, like there's an energy out there. Or am I hallucinating again?
No, I guess if you're not here all the time, maybe you feel that.
When you go out in the deep, thick woods, I'm not talking, oh, I got a tree in the yard. No, that's not what I'm saying. There seems like there's a magical energy to me. And that's why
I think especially up here in the Keweenaw Peninsula, there's a kind of mysterious, magical aura about it.
Now, I got an email from your dad, from Walt, the other day. And he said, you know, you guys had that tremor or whatever it was near Stevenson. And I didn't, you know, I wanted to mention it on my show because what is that? But he said, well, I know somebody that has done some investigating into the history of these things that have taken place. And I said, really? Yeah, he said, Lisa. And I said, well, how would I contact somebody like that Lisa Scheel? I mean, she's got to be hard to reach, right? He goes, well, I might know somebody that can contact her. So then, and actually, I sent you an email. That was your dad. So you've looked into the past, Michigan's past, in this book that you wrote. Some strange tales, but also going back and like the history of what's taken place with earthquakes. Those were quite common, or at least they were more abundant than we realize, right?
Right. Most people don't realize that there have been any earthquakes in the Upper Peninsula.
Now, how far back did you go to find some of these?
I went back pretty far, but I found there was most of the earthquakes happened between 1902 and 1909, when there were more than 20 of them.
More than 20? Now, how big earthquakes were they?
Well, there weren't any seismographs in the area at the time.
Yeah, that's true.
There still really aren't any. So they're starting to put some in.
That's true. How would you measure it? Well, I shook like this.
But what modern scientists do is they look at the damage that was done and try to estimate. But for most of the ones that happened in the UP, there aren't really any estimates of what it was on the Richter scale.
That's true. And furthermore, how could you probably, you know, we were pretty sparse with population back then, weren't we?
No, there were quite a lot of people in the UP.
Back in the early
90s? Especially in the Keweenaw with the copper
mining. Oh, okay, yeah, over that era.
The heyday of the copper mining era. And there were also the lumber camps. Iron mines. There were quite a lot of people in here. Calumet was a big town.
Yes, it was. I remember hearing about that. So actually, there were more people probably back then in Upper Michigan.
Could be.
Than there is now.
There were certainly more people in the Keweenaw than there are today.
Right now, Upper Michigan's population is about 300,000, somewhere in there. And Calumet alone was over 150,000 or 100,000 people, something like that.
Yeah, there were a lot of people up here. And there aren't that many people in the whole Keweenaw now.
Now it's a great place to go see. I'll tell you what, if you want a vacation, if you want to get away from the rat race, it is incredibly beautiful in the Keweenaw. You have Lake Superior around there, and you have inland lakes, and it's just it's a beautiful spot. Most people might think of it, but...
And we also have fault lines.
Yeah, you seem to have more over there than in my direction, too, because I'm in the central UP. And
well, I have seen maps of the western part of the UP going almost to Escanaba made by the USGS that show possible fault lines, and there are quite a few of them.
Over in my spot?
Could be.
Well, we had this crack. You heard about this thing in Stevenson.
Right.
Now, what do you think that was? I mean, did you look at that a little bit?
I saw pictures of it on the Internet.
Is that like an earthquake?
Pretty big crack. Well, the geologist from Michigan Tech University who looked at it said that there could be a fault under there that nobody knows about.
That's
so nobody really knows where the faults are for sure. And
that's nice.
Other than if you go in the Quincy Mine in Hancock, which was the biggest copper mine back in the day, if you go in there on their tour, they will show you a fault that goes right through there and goes right under US 41.
Wow.
You can actually stick your fingers in it.
You know, the thing is, I think anywhere you live in the world, you're going to probably not be immune to earthquakes because they're kind of spread out all over, aren't they?
Right. I used to live in Texas, and I remember in a college geology class, the professor brought out a big map of the faults in Texas, and they were just everywhere. All over the place.
And some of them maybe could be more severe spots than others, do you think, Lisa?
Some more likely to have earthquakes, yeah. But, of course, scientists understand pretty well how earthquakes on the margins of continental plates work. You know, like California, when they have earthquakes, that's because of the plates crashing together. But earthquakes that happen inside the plates, like in the middle of North America, nobody understands how that works or why it happens.
Now, is there a fault line that runs along the Mississippi River?
Absolutely.
And that's the one back in the 1800s. I remember seeing this story more than once and reading about it, how the earth shook for several days.
Yep, in New Madrid, Missouri was the center of it all.
And people there thought
They've been having earthquakes down there again recently.
Really?
Yeah, they've been having them in Oklahoma and Arkansas.
Do you think we're due for something big?
It's hard to tell. I mean, nobody knows how these kind of fault lines work.
So if we have a little shake here and there, is that leading to something else, or is it just we could never see it again for a long time?
Nobody knows. It could be nothing. It could be just a one-time thing, or it could be...
I'm hoping it's a one-time thing.
Yeah, let's hope that. Let's keep our fingers crossed for that.
Because that one that was in Stevenson is only about 20 miles from where I live, and I'm thinking, it's a little close there. And I don't even know if I have earthquake insurance. What happens if, you know... ground splits open.
I don't know about that.
I think I'm going to be living in a crevice.
I mean, I used to live in California.
So that you were probably used to that out there, right?
Yeah, I felt a couple earthquakes. Not any of the big ones. I wasn't there for any of the big ones, luckily.
So where did you get all the information for Forgotten Tales of Michigan's Upper Peninsula? You must have gone through a lot of different libraries.
It's mainly from historical newspaper stories.
Okay.
So I went through a lot of old newspapers searching for those little stories that nobody remembers anymore.
Isn't it something? You know, reading through this book, and I read most of it, it's just amazing how we've forgotten so many things. And I can only imagine in our history the things that we've forgotten, you know, that
right.
really took place. These were things that were, maybe because we were more community-minded at one time, we were family-knit, and stories were shared, and now I think we're all, with the exception of your family, we're all so busy, and we're on the go, which is good. I applaud your family for living the way they do. And if I could afford it right now, I'd do the same, if my wife would let me, too. But, you know, we've lost sight.
I think also today we're just so bombarded with 24-hour news channels.
Right.
Everything that you don't really think about looking back at history. To find these kind of stories.
Well, there's some really unique stories that are in this book, and some of which we're going to talk about, and some of it's a little bizarre, as we kind of expect from you, Lisa. And at least I do. And I know you write some very scientific approaches to some of the things you've worked on in the past, but then you've also talked about Sasquatch flying on a UFO. I mean, that's a little out there, isn't it? Right?
Not to me.
No, me neither. But some people might say, what? She came to a conclusion, and you'll hear it in our earlier interviews about the possibility of witnesses, eyewitnesses, seeing Sasquatch, Bigfoot. There seems to be a connection. People have seen them near UFOs or even in UFOs. But we're not going to get into that right now. We're going to get into the talk about some of the stories that you have in your book. You talked a lot about wild men in this book. Now, these are stories dating back to the early part of 1900. Some of these people were actually wild men that went off the deep end, right?
Right. Some of them were just guys who went out in the woods and lost it a little. Mm. Or maybe they went in the woods because they'd already lost it.
And then
other
some
ones are more mysterious.
That's the ones I want to talk about. Now, so, could you recall any of the stories offhand?
Oh, yeah. There have been quite a few. Wild men is what they used to call what we would call Bigfoot today.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't have that term. That term came about in the 1950s. So they would call them wild men. Sometimes they'd call them gorillas or, you know, various things. There were various local, colorful little local names.
So these things have been these things have been spotted for a long time.
Oh yeah, they've been around for hundreds, if not thousands, of years.
But as far as eyewitness testimony, I mean, we can only go back so far, right?
Right. Well, yeah. As far as there are written records, and I got these from newspaper reports.
So can you tell us about one of the stories?
Well, in 1901, near Crystal Falls, is in the far western UP.
Crystal Falls, Michigan.
There
it's
was
about
a wild man who was seen quite a few times, and he was described as being the typical wild man, which a typical wild man was supposed to be hairy, you know, but walking upright like a person, but being hairy all over. And there were quite a few people who saw this wild man in October of 1901. He was seen near the headwaters of the Deer River, which is 14 miles outside of Crystal Falls. And a hunter got about 30 feet away from him. And this wild man was apparently chowing down on a skunk. Which sounds like a delicious meal to me.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the wild man snarled at the hunters, and then he took off into the woods. And he was described as having long hair and carrying a piece of a gun barrel and a tent pole.
A piece of a gun barrel.
He wasn't eating the skunk.
He was carrying part of a gun barrel?
Yeah, a piece of gun barrel and a tent pole. And the hunters thought that his snarling sounded kind of like the word public, so they decided he must have been from the town of Republic.
Oh, yes.
Was nearby.
Now, what do you make of all this? Because you've done Sasquatch investigations and talked to people and stuff like that. Do you think that this could be a Bigfoot?
It could have been, yeah.
Or
could it all over the place.
Could it have been a human being that was just really hairy and went off the deep end?
Well, you never can tell for sure when you're looking back.
They don't describe the size of this thing, do they? They don't describe how big it was?
No, the newspaper reports aren't that specific.
Okay.
But he was described as making unearthly yells that were sort of like a dog's bark, but not quite.
But don't you think, like, a lot of the Bigfoot sightings are very similar?
Yeah, there are a lot of similarities.
I mean, do you remember hearing any Bigfoots, like, with a part of a gun in their hand?
Well, they've been seen carrying all sorts of things. You
know, they have been seen carrying
all sorts. They found stuff in the woods. Who knows?
And so they're walking around in it. See, I haven't heard those kind of reports. I guess the ones I hear are, like, people see something for just a moment.
Right, that's what they are today, is mainly.
But there was a time
across the road in front of them or something.
When they're seen carrying animals.
Right.
And eating those animals as well, you're saying?
Right, yeah. There have been more recent reports of people seeing Bigfoot carrying dead deer.
Hmm.
Or, you know, other kinds of dead animals and things like that.
So just hypothetically, where do you think these things, how do they disguise themselves? Because don't we have people out all and about, you think that, I mean, how do they avoid us?
It's not that hard. There's lots of woods where people rarely, if ever, go. Even here in the UP, there are not people in every inch of the woods all the time.
But wouldn't we be able to find, like, a carcass or something?
Well, how often do you find a wild animal that died naturally?
I find them on the road.
You don't find them.
I find them on the road all the time.
On the road, I mean, out in the woods.
Yeah, I know they can.
You don't see a lot of dead bears.
They can decompose
the
rather quickly.
Yeah, they get the carcasses get ripped up and carried off, and Right.
Do you think, now we've talked about this with other people, and I think I probably asked you this question, but just because this is my job, some people kind of believe they're like spirit animals. They're like from another dimension, and they open a door, and they come here, and they go.
Right, I've heard that before.
How do you feel about that? Don't know?
No, I'm not real convinced on that one.
Okay. Because to me, that would at least explain how come we never find them, and they just seem to be gone. They're here one moment, and they're gone. And like, there are other things that seem to show up here and are here for a while and be gone. Now, you also talked about, and I've never heard this before, people seeing sea serpents on the Great Lakes or something that there's just no way that this fits in, you know? Something okay. that was either prehistoric, you know, it's not just in Loch Ness. What are some of the stories or some of the accounts with that?
Well, it turns out that the sea serpents have been seen on all the Great Lakes. And the ones that connect to the UP, they've been seen on those. You know, Superior, Michigan, and Huron are the ones that border the UP. And they've been seen on all three of those. And in the late 19th century, one was seen in the waters around Mackinac Island.
Yipe.
And one was even seen in Otrane Lake.
Yeah, I've been on the Otrane, the river that runs between Lake Superior. I've kayaked out on that many times. And I could only imagine if something with a long neck stuck its head out of the
right.
water.
Well, this was in the late 19th century. Two brothers were canoeing on that lake, and this creature came along and circled around their canoe, chattering its teeth.
Wow.
And one of the brothers smacked it in the head with a paddle, and it sank and went out of sight.
Now, this wasn't as big as what, you know, people describe the Loch Ness Monster?
That one didn't say how big it was, but I would imagine it wasn't that big.
But there have been other ones reported, because I read some of those stories in your book, that said these creatures were pretty big, pretty huge.
Right, they can be big.
And it sounded a lot like the Loch Ness critter.
Yeah, it's quite similar in description, being a kind of serpent-like thing.
And those were spotted. Those were spotted in what time frame? In your research that you found?
In the late 1800s, the 1890s, and in the early part of the 20th century. That's about as far as I go with the stories in the book. Is about 1920.
So we don't know if people saw that afterwards. Because I was always wondering, do they still see them today, and it just doesn't get reported, or have these things disappeared?
I have read a few reports from more recent times of people seeing them.
That's really weird. That would freak me out, you know? Sometimes I kayak on the Great Lakes, usually Lake Michigan because it's not as cold, you know?
Lake Superior. Well, watch out.
And that would just be like, and I'm always fairly close to shore, so, but wow. We're going to take a break. Lisa Scheel is the author of Forgotten Tales of Michigan's Upper Peninsula, as well as other books, many, many other books. And you can find out more about her at lisascheel.com.
Out there.
You can go back and look at some of the shows that Lisa and I have done. I've probably had her on at least three or four more other times in the past. She was one of the first paranormal researchers, if you want to call her that, that I've talked to. She used to be with MUFON. And she also did some, you know, she talked to some people, not so much driving around for investigations, but has talked to people about Bigfoot experiences, those kind of things. So, and she's now branched out into another direction. And I think that's what happens with everybody. They move on to other things, and her interests, I'm sure, are always changing. But what's really cool is that her mom, as well as her, but her mother had an experience with these huge orbs. And Lisa and I have talked about that before. And I just thought that was, what is that? And then we've talked about, you know, their missing time, her and her mother. Now, Dad, Walt hasn't had so much of that himself, although he told me, and he's a skeptic. He did one time, he was hunting near their property, on their property, and out of the corner of his eye, he saw something staring at him, and it wasn't a bear, and it was big, and it was very hairy. Now, what was it? He doesn't know, and he still doesn't buy into everything that they, you know, that Mom and Lisa talk about. But it's interesting, you know, what's going on. Anyway, next week we're going to finally have the fellow on I was talking about. He wrote a book. His name is Gerald Kubicki. The name of his book is The Dubious Mission. It's actually a fictional book, but it's mixed in with some truth. Some of his own life experiences of living in a haunted house, but also some history. He's kind of a history buff, and I think in a way he's trying to let us know about some things in our history are not 100% accurate, and I agree with that. And this centers around World War II. So I hope you find it interesting. Or maybe you will find it, or maybe you won't. We'll talk to him next week on Out There. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Frank Fascino Jr., and you're listening to Out There with TJ.
My name is TJ Ryan. It's Lisa Scheel on the phone. She is calling from the woods, literally. Out in, how many acres does your family have out there?
40.
40 acres of woods. We used to have a camp not far from here, actually over towards Hardwood La Branch area. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No.
Well, it's about maybe 20 miles from Escanaba. And when I was a kid, we went out into the deep woods. That's why I have that feeling about the deep woods. We were way out, at least 5 miles down a dirt two-rut road. And, you know, you just get out there. And, you know, I'd like to go out for hunting season, but I'm not much of a killer. But I just love being out in the woods. And that, to me, why? Why is that? And that's what I was asking you earlier. What is the attraction? To me, it's a way to reconnect because you get away from all the noise and everything.
Right, get away from all the technology that can really get in the way.
To me, it's, well, don't you think, Lisa, and I know this is kind of a personal question, but we're natural beings. We grew up in a natural world, and in a way, we've made it unnatural. Or do you see things differently?
Well, we have changed our culture significantly with all our technology.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been studies that have shown that we're even altering our brains.
Because of that. Is that a good thing or bad thing?
Yeah, who knows?
Don't know. But you like the simpler way of living.
Right. I like to be out in the woods, and I'm not addicted to technology.
Good for you. And I'm not addicted, but I have to live with it in order to do what I do. We're going to talk about, now you have so many different stories in this book. I mean, some are just people acting crazy and going off the deep end, and, you know, I'm sure it was a tough life for miners. You know, I had a guy on who wrote a book who was from Nagani not too long ago called UP, and his book was, it was a fictional book, but it was about, it was taken from some of his own life, and he grew up in Nagani, which is obviously a huge mining area, right? And he said there was a lot of negativity because of the way of life. It was a tough life, right?
Well, back in the days when they were mining actively,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was tough for the miners. It was not a fun thing to be a miner back then.
Not only
well,
that.
It probably isn't today either.
Not only that, but, you know, people were, I don't know, it was a mentality, it seemed like, that
right,
went
the kind
with
of
it.
People who were attracted to working in mines, who would be willing to put up with those kind of conditions.
Right. And they lived
rough and tumble characters.
They lived hard and they played hard, right?
Definitely.
So we're going to talk about, there's a story you had in there about a miner, I'm guessing you'll remember this, who, because some of these mines, people might say they're haunted, there's spirits around. You had a story about a guy who was going to a place where the miners change. What is that facility called? You remember that?
The dry house.
The dry house.
The dry house.
Yeah, that one caught my attention. What happened there with that guy?
Well, he was in there, and he saw this apparition come down from the ceiling, and then it went down and disappeared into some boots. And he didn't know what that was, but it scared the heck out of him, and he ran out of there and refused to ever go back in the dry house.
Now, these stories are reported in the local newspapers, you said?
Yep.
And people,
they were in the newspapers at the time.
And so that guy, I mean, imagine if any of us nowadays wanted to go to the newspapers. You know, I think I saw a ghost.
They would never get in there.
Well, they'd also might label us or laugh at us.
Well, they did that back then, too. too.
Did they?
They would sometimes make fun of the people.
But they still put them in the newspaper.
Yeah, they still put it in the paper.
Isn't that amazing? I think that's kind of neat.
I know it is. It's so different from today.
You were getting what really happened in any community. Now imagine all the stories that go untold nowadays. So that's right. What's kind of neat. I'm reading these things, and you say you got them out of the newspapers.
Right.
And they were willing to talk about anything.
Oh, yeah.
And now they're also, I didn't really look at the story too much, but wasn't there a story about a haunted mine?
There were some miners who were down in one of the mines. It was an iron mine. And they were coming up the shaft. They would be in these little cars that went up the shaft. And there was next to them cars that would go down. And so they were coming up, and they saw something white there in the other part of the shaft. And it seemed to be moving, and they thought it was a ghost. And they when they came out of the mine, they were all terrified. And they were telling everybody about this ghost they had seen down there in the mine. So, you know, the officials running the mine couldn't have that because the miners didn't want to go back down there. So they had to do something about this. So they went down there, and they found some rotten timbers, and they decided that it had been a phosphorescent glow from the rotting timbers that they had seen, and that it wasn't anything at all. So then most of the miners went back, but there were a few who never did want to go back down.
Hmm. And nothing more was proven one way or the other on that.
Nope.
It's just one of those, you know, a lot of those stories are just being relayed. But you wonder how much of it actually was real that was experienced by these people. Now, there's another thing I thought was really interesting, because I've heard about this before, and it's kind of like shape-shifting, which I've heard Native American people talk about, and I've heard others talk about it. And shape-shifting is the ability for a person to change into an animal and then change back, or vice versa. You had a story. I just thought this was really cool, you know, because I'm into this kind of stuff. But I'm into all the other stuff, too. I mean, they were just regular stories about people who did things. But I like the more bizarre ones, Lisa, as you can tell. What was the name of that story? You called it Roop Guru or something like that?
Roop Guru.
Guru.
It's in Sault Ste. Marie back in the 1800s, they called it the Roop Guru. It was a French-Canadian legend that was originally called the Loop Guru with an L. But in Sault Ste. Marie, it got changed to Roop Guru, and this was people who would change into animals.
That just sounds crazy, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, but it's some of the folklore that the French Canadians brought with them.
And so what was the one story about this woman who was an owl or something like that? You remember that one?
Yeah.
You remember that one?
Yeah, there was a family, and the grandmother got sick. She was sick for a long time. And then one night an owl perched outside her window, and an owl would come back every night. And so her daughter decided that this was a Roop Guru, and this was one of their neighbors who was doing this to them, trying to curse the old woman to have her die.
Mm.
So the daughter asked her nephew to go outside and kill the owl one night. And so he did kill it, and it dropped onto the ground, and the nephew went back in the house to put his gun away, but when he came back to pick up the carcass, the owl was gone. So he searched the whole area, he went down the road and searched, and there he found a neighbor woman crawling back to her house, seemingly injured. So that's why they decided that this owl had actually been a Roop Guru, and that their neighbor had been trying to kill the grandmother. For some reason.
Now, didn't this neighbor pass away shortly after that, and the grandmother recovered completely from health?
Yeah, the grandmother got better. Yeah.
And so,
grandmother did get better. But the woman who they thought had been the owl did die.
And then right after she died.
Nobody was really sure what had happened to her.
Yeah. So, I mean, it could be a weird coincidence. I just think it's a kind of a neat story. And just imagine, when you put yourself back into that time frame, people must have really been... Would you think they're more superstitious or...
I think they were more willing to believe in these things and more willing to admit they believed in superstitions like this. Today, people are quite often so afraid of being ridiculed that they don't want to admit to believing in anything.
And a lot of these things were handed down for generations. And even if the truth is not accurate on them, you had many, many stories to back these things up.
Yeah, it's the folklore, the regional folklore.
And so sometimes...
Even if you don't believe that this is actually what happened, it's interesting to read the folklore.
I think it is, too.
Believe.
And in a way, it's kind of a way to, I look at it, is maybe you can draw some evidence to some things that others have said or that you've experienced yourself.
Right.
And say, well, maybe there's something to this that, you know, as far as the Sasquatch, we've talked about that before. I truly believe they are up here. You've shared stories about that with me. More recently, you talked to, like, people. You told me a story about somebody in Pierce Gorge who, near Pierce Gorge, was in their car where they had been partying or sleeping. Remember that one, Lisa?
No. Maybe I don't know any story from that area.
Maybe it was somebody else. You told me about also somebody that was on heading the Big Bay, maybe, between Marquette and Big Bay, in their car. Do you remember that one?
I don't think that was me either.
Well, who would I have been talking to? These were like reports that people... Do you remember any reports that we might have talked about or any that you can think of offhand?
I haven't really had any Bigfoot reports recently.
Okay. Somebody in Gwynn, do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, that was a few years ago.
What was the story behind that?
That was a man who was canoeing on a private lake, and this was in June of 2006. It was 8:30 at night, so it was still light out. He was canoeing on this lake when he spotted something on the shoreline about 30 yards away, and it was a hairy bipedal creature. So he was watching it, and this Bigfoot was drinking water from the lake using a concave piece of wood as if it were a cup.
Hmm.
So the witness was watching it. He thought it was a bear at first, then he realized that it walked on two legs.
Mm.
And then it stood up, and it was 7 to 8 feet tall. And he looked at it, and it looked at him for about 20 to 30 seconds. And then the Bigfoot limped off into the woods, seemed to be injured because it was limping a little bit. So the witness paddled over there to where it had been, but it was gone. And he didn't find any footprints, but he did see what could have been knee imprints from where it was kneeling on the shore. And he also said that back in 1959, his great uncle had seen something similar in the same area.
No kidding.
His family owns property.
Wow. That's interesting. Now, you have actually, haven't you had glimpses of things around your area?
Just a glimpse, yeah.
And you also felt that they were braiding your horse's hair.
Right. And that's something that has been reported around the world.
And leaving stick signs, too, right?
Right, yeah.
Like communicating with you.
I think it's some kind of communication.
Could you stop by and pick up a skunk at the store on the way home? I'm hungry. Think they're saying that?
Maybe.
And then even you and I talked about this before we did the interview, about maybe riding the horses. As crazy as that sounds. You feel they've been doing that with your horses?
It could be. There have been a couple of times when one of the horses would turn up with a strange impression on its back as if someone had been riding it.
Hmm.
And it wasn't any of us.
And you don't have any neighbors close by?
Nope, no close by neighbors who would be tromping through the woods just to ride my horse.
Right. Now, when you say you found stick signs before, what did they look like?
Some people, you might hear some other Bigfoot researchers talk about stick signs, but what they're really talking about is trees that have been bent over.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I'm talking about is actual sticks that have been broken. You know, they're usually about a foot long, 6 inches to a foot long, and maybe an inch in diameter. They've been broken off of something, and they've been laid out in distinctly unnatural formations. I've found crosses and triangles and parallel sticks. These turn up not under trees. They're along trails, and they're out in the open. And, you know, I've had a really windy summer last year and didn't find hardly any stick signs. So I don't think it's just the wind blowing these things down into these distinct formations. So it's a mysterious thing that I think is Bigfoot related, because I have also found footprints, not human footprints, but large footprints that don't have an arch in them, which is typical of Bigfoot.
Now, what draws you to this, Lisa? Why do you believe that this is all possible?
I guess I'm just open-minded.
I mean, did you have an experience?
I've had a lot of strange experiences. I guess I probably believed in UFOs before Bigfoot, because I had a UFO sighting when I was about 14. And I've just been more and more interested in strange things ever since then.
Mm-hmm. And you and your mom has witnessed things as well, right along with you. You both, as you told me earlier, down in Texas, witnessed this craft, and you both actually had missing time.
Right.
Which may not be a good thing. That may not be a bad thing, neither.
Well, I don't really think about it as being a bad thing.
Now,
I don't know what happened, you know, but...
You've written several books. Do you want to name some of those? Backyard Bigfoot actually won an award, didn't it?
Right. Was a finalist in the Forward Magazine Book of the Year Awards.
And she describes through her own understanding and research of how what do you call them? Hominoids?
In the book, I call them hairy hominids, just to be clear, because some of them aren't big.
Right.
There are Bigfoot-like creatures all around the world that are various sizes, mm-hmm. and shapes, and colors, just like people.
And would you theorize that this is like an ancient race that just hasn't evolved, or how do you see them as?
I think they're related to the ancient hominid species, the fossil creatures that we find, Homo erectus, and those kind of things. Because if you look at reconstructions of those creatures, they look a lot more like a Bigfoot than they do
actually,
like us.
Actually, you know, I take that back, because you don't believe in evolution.
That's right. I also wrote a book, The Evolution Conspiracy.
And you know what? I don't anymore, neither. I don't believe that we probably have, after reading your book and another fellow we had on, that we haven't. Everything has been already designed the way it is, right? We might adapt, but we don't really evolve.
Well, the fact is that we don't have enough evidence to know exactly how life came about, any form of life, you know, or especially how human beings came about. All we have is bits of fossils, and the further back you go in time, the teenier those bits get.
Mm-hmm. So there's no definite answer.
We don't have the evidence to know for sure what happened.
There's no definite answer. Well, if you want to find out more about Lisa, do you want to mention any other books that you've written?
I also have Strange Michigan, and I have my novel, The Hunt for Bigfoot and Lord of the Dead.
And if you want to find out more about Lisa, lisascheel.com. S-H-I-E-L is how you spell Scheel. Lisa, it's always interesting to talk to you. The book has many more stories than we've talked about. Some of them are just really unique, going back over 100 years. And some of them are a little bizarre. And some of them are really strange. But that's why I like it. And they're really short stories, so you can move on from one to another. Thank you very much for being on the show, Lisa.
Thank you.
Music on Out There, created by Kevin MacLeod.